Hello, everybody, and welcome to Elmtown episode 25. Today, we're going to talk about the evolution of an API again, but not with Matt this time, instead with Richard. You here, Richard?
Hello.
Here he is. But don't talk yet, Richard, because I have to talk about the sponsors first. First, we've got Day One, which is the company that I work for. I love Day One. We make a beautiful, if I do say so myself, journaling app for Mac, iOS, and Android, and web beta, which is the work I've been doing for a while and involved with other work too. But there you go. We make a journaling app for those platforms and I love it. And I think you'll love it too if you try it out. And thanks to Day One for being a sponsor. Next, Daily Drip, which makes keeping up to date on programming skills easy. Daily Drip will save you a ton of time by providing quality lessons and resources for you right off the bat. Some topics include Elixir, Crystal, React Native, Go, HTML, and of course, Elm. Now that's a lot of topics, but there are a lot of lessons on each topic too. So you can pick and choose what you like, learn faster and more efficiently with Daily Drip, and be a better developer. Every weekday, if you sign up, you'll get a short video, about 5 minutes, delivered to your inbox. You can sign up at dailydrip.com and use the coupon code ELMTOWN, all lowercase, all one word, ELMTOWN-2018, and you'll get a 14-day free trial. And they'll know that you came from our show, which is good for us too. Third, but not least, is Futurus, which is a new breed of innovation consultancy with digital values at its core. They believe in happy people, happy customers, and happy users. They're users of Elm, community contributors, and innovators in the open source space. They hire good people. They do good work. We're grateful to them for sponsoring the show. And please check them out, especially if you're interested in finding a great job. And if you're in Europe, it'll be even easier. You won't have to relocate because they have lots of places all over Europe too. I shouldn't say you won't have to relocate. You might not have to relocate. And then fourth but not least, I should have saved that because it's also last, is Ellie, which we all love, which is the Elm Live editor, which has been a great contribution to the community by Luke Westby. And so big thanks to Ellie for sponsoring the podcast as well. Now, I want to give a big thank you and recognition, even though I'm not supposed to Fergus Meeklejohn, who edits these episodes for us and helps produce the podcast. So big thank you. Thank you, Fergus. And I'll probably never stop saying thank you, even though you want me to. So thank you. Thank you. And I'm going to pre-excuse myself in case the construction that's going on literally next door continues going on. I mean, there may be a bathroom between me and the construction at some point, but it sure sounds like it's right on the other side of my whiteboard. So if you start hearing funny sounds, it could be Richard's voice or it could be the construction. Just kidding. Richard, you have a beautiful voice. And why don't you give us some of that beautiful voice right now and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Richard.
All right. That's the podcast, everybody. Thank you.
Boom. No, I'm kidding. Nailed it.
Okay, Richard, I think that if people have been listening to the podcast or watching videos or have been using Elm at all, they probably know your name, Richard Feldman, because you've been involved quite a bit in Elm. So why don't you give yourself just like a basic introduction for first-time listeners?
Sure. So I'm Richard. I work at No Red Ink. We make grammar and writing stuff for English teachers.
Hey, wait a second.
We're hiring.
Oh, no. I was going to see if I could say it because you always say that. I wanted to be the one to say it. Anyway, that's fine. You go ahead. hiring. There you go.
Yeah. we hired Evan. He works with us. He's awesome. Evan made Elm.
Yes.
But, I guess this is a me introduction. So, I am currently writing Elm in Action for Manning Publications. I did a two-day Elm workshop for front-end masters. I do a lot of talks about Elm. I maintain a lot of open-source Elm libraries. We write a lot of Elm at work. So, yeah, I'm really into Elm.
So how did you get so into Elm? I mean, we don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but just to recap and let people know, how did you get into it?
Yeah, so it's funny. I actually came into Elm because I was a front-end programmer. Well, I guess I was back-end before that. And then I kind of got into front-end and really started to fall in love with creating UIs. And I had a friend who was always talking to me about functional programming. And so I was into kind of JavaScript, and I thought CoffeeScript was pretty cool because, it was a lot nicer. This was like 2011.
It was pretty cool. I'm just going to say that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Made a lot of things nicer, and he was like, you know, there's a whole world of other programming languages out there that are actually very different from what you're used to. And so we would go to lunch, we'd talk about programming and stuff like that, and he kind of explained Lisp and Haskell and all these other languages that I had no idea about. And I was like, this sounds really cool, but how can I get to use these on the front end? I mean, I work in the browser, so none of these languages that he was talking about had a really compelling compile to JS story. So I kind of started keeping a lookout for that had some of the characteristics of these really different languages that he was talking about. And eventually, to make a long story short, Elm came out with this blog post, Blazing Fast HTML in Elm. And I was like, wow, this seems like this language checks all my boxes. It's got everything that I'm looking for to try and get into this world. Let me give it a shot. So I tried it on a side project I'd been working on and just totally fell in love with it. And I've been more or less obsessed with it ever since.
And it's become a big part of your career, it seems, too, because you started using it at work, you started hiring people for it. You're kind of one of the two people that gets invited to talk all over the world about it too, and I'm guessing you've done that a lot in the past couple of years, right?
It's definitely more than just two of us, but yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, I do get invited to talk about Elm. Recently, just did that this week. Actually, got invited to talk about Elm in Italy, which is really cool. And it's a, I guess I could say this. It's not totally a done deal yet, but hopefully it will be by the time the podcast comes out. It's a keynote conference.
All right.
So. That I don't know what that says about Elm's popularity, that a general purpose, 2,000 person programming conference wants to have somebody come keynote it about Elm, but
cool.
Certainly interest.
Yeah, definitely. So we're here to talk today, not just about adopting Elm, but tell me then about, what we're going to talk about is evolution of the API, kind of like we did with Matt a couple episodes ago. So you have contributed to or authored a few packages, right, for the Elm package repo.
You could say that. Right. Yeah.
Which ones are we going to talk about today? I mean, I said that like a few packages because it's kind of sarcastic because you've done some pretty important packages, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Elm CSS, I'm guessing, is one of them. Do you want to talk about another?
Yeah. I think we can probably mention Elm Test. I would say Elm CSS has evolved a lot more. So in the context of evolution, I think probably like the three packages that I sort of like came up with, I guess, would be Elm CSS, the current Elm Test, and Decode Pipeline. But Decode Pipeline has really not changed much since the initial idea. Elm Test, I mean, Max Goldstein and I sort of redesigned that based on the original Elm Test. It was kind of a scratch rewrite. But after that initial evolution, there hasn't been a whole lot of changes there either. But Elm CSS has gone through the evolution. So I guess that's the one that makes the most sense to talk about.
Perfect. Well, we'll do that. And so let's talk about Elm CSS. What was your very first rendition of Elm CSS? What did the API look like?
So the original idea was I wanted to make a CSS preprocessor like Sass or Less or Stylus. So it would run at build time. And my idea at the time, this is about 3 years ago now, I want to say, like 2015-ish. The original idea was the only problem I was really setting out to solve was being able to share class names between the view code and the style sheet. So I wanted to solve this problem where you delete something, like you delete a class. You know, this is back when it was extremely common to just manually manage all of your class names. And you delete a class and you're not sure if it was safe to delete. You're like, well, maybe it's being used nowhere, or maybe it's actually still being used somewhere deep in my views. And, this is going to cause a regression, but I won't get any compile time help for that. This is not a big deal if you have a really specific class name, but if you have something kind of generic and you try to grep through that through your whole code base and you get, you know, a couple hundred results, it's hard to be confident like that. So my idea was, well, the major things that CSS preprocessors provide on top of just plain CSS style sheets are things like being able to import code, like have modules. And I was like, well, if I write it in Elm, we have a module system. And then being able to share styles between different things. I was like, well, we can do that too. We just have values in Elm and you can write functions, helper functions and things like that. So it seemed like just by writing it in Elm, we could end up with all of the features of the major CSS preprocessors, but with the additional benefit of being able to actually share some code between the views and the style sheet and make them a little bit more maintainable. So that was kind of the original vision. It was a pretty narrow set of problems that I was hoping to solve.
It sounds like the scope exploded on that one.
You know, it's funny because it exploded and then contracted and then shifted.
All right, let's read the steps.
Been an interesting journey. So when I first got into it, so we mentioned earlier, how I got into Elm was I had this friend, and his name's Deech. He's Deech on Twitter, D-E-E-C-H. And we used to go to lunch when I lived in St. Louis and talk about programming languages. And a thing that I was really, I don't want to say hung up on, that's kind of uncharitable, but I was really concerned with syntax. Like, to me, one of the big differences between CoffeeScript and JavaScript was the syntax. And I was like, the syntax is so much cleaner. I don't have to use parentheses as much. I don't have to use curly braces as much. It's really nice. And for him, he's like, I don't really care about syntax. I care about semantics. Like, I'm over syntax. And I was like, that's silly. I'm not over. Who's over syntax? Nobody's like, come on. It's a taste thing. And I'm definitely not that far. Like, I'm not in the camp of syntax doesn't matter by any stretch. I think syntax definitely matters. But having now used languages with radically different semantics, such as Elm and also Rust and, you know, other languages, I've come to appreciate that, yeah, if I had to pick one, like, I care more about semantics now than I do about syntax. And like, when I got into Rust, even though it had like that Elm doesn't have, like for blocks, and it was kind of a less aesthetically appealing syntax to me than Elm's, it really didn't bother me in the way that I think it would have back in, you know, 2011-ish. I mention this because when I made Elm CSS, the first version, which was initially called Elm Style Sheets, because somebody else had made a library called Elm CSS, but it ended up getting abandoned, and I was like, I like that name better. I'm just going to switch it. So the original design was actually very focused on syntax. If you can believe this, this was actually before Elm format existed. And so I came up with this absolutely horrendous DSL that was designed to make it look as much like SAS as possible. And the way that I did this was with an enormous set of custom infix operators. And they looked like pipe-pipe, which was supposed to look like a bullet point. And then there was stuff like pipe star pipe, which did something else. I don't really remember what that... Oh, yeah, and then I had like pipe.pipe for classes. And then pipe hash pipe, which was a Weezer song. No, I'm just kidding. pipe hash pipe, which was for ID selectors.
It sounds like you were, and it was like, doing if you this just, the Haskell way, it sounds like.
I don't know what kind of way I was doing it, but the point was I was really concerned about, I was like, nobody's going to use this library unless it looks like SAS, you know, as close to SAS as possible. And there were these wild rules about how you had to indent things, like, because again, there was no Elm format at the time, to make it look like CSS. But there were ways that you could have things that would compile, but wouldn't make any sense. And the reason that they had to be able to compile was so that I could support this syntax. And at the time, those were my priorities. I didn't really appreciate it's not that I didn't appreciate, maybe, but rather that I was more focused on how the code was going to look than on all of these other considerations that I have since come to appreciate as being a really important parts of API design. Things like, what'll the error messages look like? Shoot yourself in the foot.
Definitely.
If I make a silly mistake, is it going to catch it at compile time, or am I going to have to find that myself? And so I started off with this design, and I sort of got the basics working. I gave a lightning talk that kind of demoed it. It was sort of well received. It was funny because when I was doing the lightning talk, it was at a ReactiveConf 2015, and it was sort of a general front end conference. So I showed the basic thing. It was another interesting story. I was there with Noah Hall, and this is going to be relevant later. I had this demo where it was basically like I would save it and then it would spit out some, like it was, I think it was going to debug.log some CSS because I hadn't actually built the CLI yet. And it would just log the string and then I could copy paste that into a CSS.css file and load it up in the browser. But it was a pretty clunky demo. And Noah was like, well, what if you just injected it into a style tag on the fly in a running program?
Ooh.
I was like, oh yeah, then I could just demo it live and I could just focus on, look, here's how I changed the code, go back, refresh the page, and then it's right there. Yeah, that's a great idea. And I mentioned this because back then, putting CSS into style tags at runtime was almost unheard of. I mean, it was really, really unusual. Which is funny because today it's very normal. It's become very normal. Now you don't do it by writing text into the style tag. You do it by injecting it with insert rule. But that's how a lot of these really popular libraries in JavaScript do it. And ultimately ended up being something that we would spend a lot of time talking about for Elm CSS. That's a little bit later in the story, I guess. But at this point, this was a pretty big breakthrough. That never occurred to me. And Noah's great. And, luckily, he was there and had that idea. And so the demo went much better. So when I was demoing it, the first thing that I did was I just changed one of the colors. I kind of showed the code. I said, hey, I've got, you know, modules because Elm has modules. I've got variables because Elm has variables. And I was like, so you can see I'll change this one color from this to that. And it's going to change it, you know, everywhere. It's going to change it in the button and this other thing. And I save that and I refresh the page and it changed and everybody applauded. And I was, oh, well, I didn't do anything yet. I mean, that's not the impressive part. The cool part is there's code sharing. So let me get to that. And then, you know, showed how it could share code between the view and the style sheet, which was, of course, the real thing that was the purpose of creating the library. So it went well. And at that point, I sort of had a basic proof of concept. I had an idea that the scope of the library should include making type-checked CSS. Like saying, when you call display none, that should compile. But if you call display 5 pixels, that shouldn't compile. Part of this was a desire to catch more bugs at compile time. But if I'm being completely honest, a significant part of it was just that initial syntax concern, was wanting it to be able to write display space none and have that be how it looks rather than having to put strings in there. So it looked nicer, but then I immediately was like, well, I could just make these all be the same type, but clearly it would be much cooler if it could be type checked. And of course, then I immediately realized that's going to be an absurdly large project trying to get, all of the CSS spec into Elm type checked and everything like that. But I was like, well, I don't know. Let's go for it. Let's go with the ambitious approach. And thus began the first of what is, I think, at this point, something like 10,000 lines of code, a lot of which is basically adding Elm types to different parts of the CSS.
Yeah, sure.
So that was sort of the initial scope of the first release of the library, was basically it compiles to CSS from Elm code. You can share types between your view and your style sheet. And there's some type checking going on to make things only compile, in theory, only compile if it's going to be a valid style sheet. There were some limitations to that, of course. You can write RGB and pass it, you know, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, and it's got to be between 0 and 255. But short of dependent types, you can't really check that at compile
time.
Sure,
you can make your own type, but that would be... insane. Like, no longer an int, you'd be like, oh yes, this is my RGB values. It would structure RGB 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. But that would be kind of crazy.
Yeah. Right. But you can't, right. Then you can no longer type out the number.
Right.
255. You have to construct it using, that would be pretty annoying to use, I think. But it's worth noting that because the goal at this point was to be a preprocessor, I was able to have this notion of warnings, So there were certain things I could do when constructing the values to check and see if they were outside the acceptable bounds. And although it couldn't be a compiler error, I could still gather up all these warnings and then give them to you at the end and say, hey, I saw that you had RGBs that were outside the bounds, etc. So that basically, that was sort of the first version. And that all worked, and I got it working, and it was pretty cool. And then I think I ran it by Evan at some point, and he made a couple of interesting observations. One is, I think as he put it, he's like, you know, this is basically a compiler. I mean, essentially what I had was I had these different functions that would create representations of how these things ought to interact. So for example, in the basic case, you have something like, here's a selector, like a class selector. And inside of that class selector, you have display none, display none makes the other ones moot. So that's kind of a boring one. you have background color green, and then you have padding 10 pixels. And ultimately that would get compiled out to a CSS string. But then you could also have an ID selector, and then you get into things like pseudo classes and pseudo elements, and you get into things like, what does it look like to have a reusable hover? And so at the end of the day, Evan said, you know, if you want to make this code nice, you probably want to do it the same way as a compiler, where you have these intermediate representations of what you're building up to. So first we had a sort of one structure that was like the pre-processed structure, which was sort of a direct translation of what the user passed in. And then we would take that and transform that into how the CSS, like the string, was going to look. So it's sort of flattening things out into declarations, resolving reusable things, and so forth, such that we ended up with this representation that was really just a one-to-one mapping, that was a data structure that very directly described the output CSS. And then finally having a step that traversed that data structure and converted everything to strings and spit all that out. Now this is the part where actually the scope ended up expanding. After realizing this, I was like, oh, wait a minute. This could be really cool because we could expose those intermediate data structures and let people build on top of those and build things that could transform them in sort of like a post CSS mm-hmm. kind of way.
Is this before community involvement? Had you released it at this point and gotten people using it?
Yeah, I'd released it. I think there were very few people using it though. Back then.
So this, at this point in iteration, this is still from like you feedback and from Evan feedback. This is like very small feedback audience at this point.
Right. I think, Luke Westby actually, I think this is the first project that he, like the first Elm open source project that he contributed to. I think he'd had a little bit of input. Like he and I had just kind of chatted about some things. But it was mostly just feedback from Evan.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Sorry, just curious about how the community was involved with that. So you were saying, and I cut you off right at the cool point, you're saying make like a post CSS kind of thing where people can interact with the data structure that represents the structure and do like auto prefixer, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually Luke wanted to take that project on was to make auto prefixer just in Elm CSS so that you didn't have to have a separate post CSS step. You could just by including the package, you could just get that. You could just call a function and say auto prefix my whole thing and it would just do it. So it was a pretty cool idea. This is going to get into another lesson that I learned eventually, which is just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. So essentially, I didn't really think through. Like I had this first thing of like, what if we could do that? That would be awesome. But I didn't actually really think through, okay, what would that look like? I mean, what would people do with that? Why is that going to be so awesome? And there's always an interesting in a position like that. On the one hand, you don't know what cool things people might do. Maybe people will do stuff that you wouldn't even think of. And by opening it up that way, you unleash creativity of people and they'll really surprise you with cool stuff that they do. But something that I've sort of appreciated more and more is that there actually is always a flip side to that, which is that, I mean, I think that's sort of the obvious one. It's sort of the upside is pretty obvious. Like this will just allow people to make more stuff. But there are some downsides that I hadn't really thought about either. One of which is, well, what happens if I want to refactor that structure? I want to change how this works internally.
All right.
now I actually kind of can't. I'm locked into that. This ended up being really relevant much later. I guess like a year or two later. Fortunately, I was saved not by my own aptitude at designing Elm APIs, which back then I can't really honestly say that I had much, but rather because I just never got around to opening it up. I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to, make like a reference implementation of either auto prefixer or something else and just kind of show how this can be used. And then I'll document it and I'll make sure the API is nice. And then I'll expose that. And then people can, just go hog wild, making all the cool plugins for this. I just never got around to it. And then much later it turned out, oh, actually it would have been a mistake to do that. And I'm glad that I didn't. That's kind of down the road. But so the second version of Elm CSS, and when I say version, I'm using this term kind of loosely, because Elm CSS has a lot of major version bumps, and not all of them are because they're actually breaking changes.
Okay.
So the reason for that is that I had to do something which I didn't realize how unusual it was at the time, but it turns out to be extremely unusual, to get the types to work out. So the basic problem is this. Let's say I have display none and I have margin none. Oh, actually, no, better example. I think auto, like float and margin both have auto, but padding doesn't. That's true. I haven't used floats in a long time, but I think float auto is a thing.
So.
If it's not, let's just pretend it is.
Okay.
There's plenty of things that have auto.
I think height has auto as well.
There you go. Cool. Height, auto, margin, auto, but padding should not be able to accept auto. Okay.
Right.
So let's say that I have height auto and margin auto, but padding should not have auto. Like I want that not to compile if I write padding auto. What is the type of auto? And you pretty quickly get into this situation where you say, okay, wait a minute. There are some things which accept auto, which only accept length values, so height can be 5 pixels, margin can also be 5 pixels. But what happens when you get into things like float that should not accept pixels? So you have this weird thing where you can't just say, oh, well, auto is one of the acceptable values for length, so auto is of type length, and then margin takes a length value and height takes a length value, and then what does float take? Because I want to be able to use auto with that too. And so pretty quickly you realize that you can't use a sort of simple type to represent values like auto or none, or even the most pervasive ones are inherit, initial, and unset. Now, granted, those don't get used very much in practice, but if you want to support them, everything has to accept them, no matter what their type is. And so I didn't really know how I was going to do this, but I basically played around with stuff and just tried different things and tried to find something that would compile. And the solution I ended up coming up with was essentially to use extensible records for this. And so what I did was I came up with a sort of useless type called compatible, and it's just type compatible equals compatible, a very boring type. But its purpose was just to kind of act as a marker. And so what I would do is I would say, okay, when I call PX and you pass it a number of some sort, and then it returns a record, and that record says length compatible. So like the length field, and then that equals compatible. And then what I can do is over in my margin function, I can say, okay, I accept an extensible record, which is to say any record that has a field called length, which is of type compatible. Which is to say any record where it's sort of a quote-unquote length compatible. So because PX returns a concrete record that says I am length compatible, then the margin function will accept that. But because it's an extensible record, I can also accept other things. So if, for example, none can return a length compatible thing as well. Or like unset or initial. So basically using extensible records as a way to say, I need at least this, but it's okay if the record has more stuff than this. So actually something like None, which is used in a bunch of different places, ends up returning a pretty enormous record. It's got the, if you look at the code that's on master right now, None, like the value None returns a record with like 30 fields in it because it can be used in so many different places.
Yeah, you're basically like saying that the return value of None has a membership in all of these different use cases.
Right,
in a different
exactly.
set of words. Yeah.
And so all of the different functions that accept None are accepting an extensible record, which includes, you know, one or two of those, you know, 32 values. And so that was the basic trick, was using extensible records to say, this can be used in more than one place as long as each of the places where it's used accepts values that are compatible with it. So it worked. It solved the problem.
It's very tricky, but it worked.
Yeah. One of the downsides of this approach is that it doesn't make for particularly nice to read documentation. Like the type signatures on these things are pretty
Agreed.
Nasty. I mean, you can imagine None returns a record with 32 fields. Well, its type is a record with 32 fields. So you can throw a type alias on that, but then the type alias becomes a little bit meaningless because so often you're accepting an extensible record and you look at that and it says, I accept something that is length or auto or None compatible, something like that. And that's the type alias. And you're like, what does that even mean? You click on it and then it explains, oh, well, it's one of these rest fields, all of which stay compatible. It's not really friendly to documentation.
Yeah, that's actually where I started using the package when it was in that state. And I can attest to using it and saying, well, where's the README? Because the types aren't helpful here at all. I mean, that was a hard part of that.
Yeah, and I also didn't do a great job with documentation earlier on. It's gotten a lot better in the current release, but back then I just didn't do a good job of documentation, just straight up. So
they're hard.
Yeah, they are. And I think that's another thing that I didn't appreciate early on. I think Evan had a good saying about this, which is like, it's not done until the docs are excellent. And I didn't really get that back then. I kind of had to learn that lesson the hard way.
It's a good saying.
But now I'm like, oh yeah, like, don't release it until the docs are excellent, because yeah, it's just you're gonna end up spending more time manually explaining things to people than you would if you just taken the time to write good documentation in the first place. But even more than that, something that I really didn't appreciate is that writing documentation actually reveals problems in the library to
you. Oh, that's a great point to write down right there.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's in the same way that, you know, there's the term rubber ducking, like you start pair programming with somebody and as you're explaining to them the problem, you realize the solution without their having said
Definitely.
Anything. And it's like, you might as well have been explaining it to a rubber duck. You'd still just the process of having to explain it to somebody who doesn't know reveals to you the problem. It's the same way with documentation.
I'll put in a plug for journaling here, because that's also does the same thing. You know, if you're not writing documentation, if it's not a documentation thing, you can actually just journal about the work you're doing and find similar benefits too. So
yeah.
That was a plug for day one, but also for real too. Okay, keep going. Sorry, Richard.
In particular, a cool thing about writing documentation is that you realize which parts are going to be hard to learn. And then you start thinking, this is so hard to explain. It would make my life easier right now if I figured out an easier way to do this. And then that can often be a source of inspiration to say, oh, wait a minute. If I changed it to this, it would be much easier to explain. Oh, it would also be much easier to use. And it sort of reveals this opportunity to improve the library. So that was a good thing to learn. But yeah, not something I did right from the gates. So bringing this back around to the original point, because I was doing this, let's say somebody they make a pull request to introduce something that we hadn't supported before, some new CSS library or part of the CSS spec. And that new thing supports None. Well, in order for it to support None, that means that None record now has to return a new field, which means that's technically a breaking change. I mean, None is a publicly available value and its type just changed to something that is actually incompatible with the old way. Now, because of the way that people use Elm CSS in practice, there's almost no chance that that's going to cause their code to no longer compile, because as it happens, all of the functions that accept none are accepting extensible records. They don't care if a new field was added. But that's really unusual. I mean, almost no packages have that property, just Elm CSS, because it's got this unusual constraint of trying to mirror the CSS API, which is sort of by its nature full of overloaded values like this. And because of that, anytime somebody made what really amounted to, in practical terms, a change where people could expect their code to still compile afterwards, we would still have to bump the major version number, because it really was a breaking change. The odds are low, but not zero, that it would break someone's build, depending on what they were doing. So because of this, I think we're in version 13 now.
Oh, that's an unlucky version. And we should skip that one.
What's funny is that 13 was actually a bug fix for 12. So really 12 was the unlucky version. It was a breaking change. I'll talk about that in a bit as well. But so this version was the one where I got the CLI going, so you could actually compile it to CSS files. It also had, because it was easy, I think somewhere around this release, I added as pairs, which is basically a way to, it just gives you back a list of string, comma, string tuples, so that you could use it with the style attribute in the Elm's virtual DOM. So that was sort of the second step in the evolution of Elm CSS, was sort of like redoing the internals, getting it so that you could actually build it from a CLI, adding these other ways that you could compile it, not just to a string, but also to pairs in addition to a style sheet. And it was set up for being able to do these arbitrary AST transformations, even though it wasn't publicly exposed yet. The one thing that I did use that for was namespacing. That was the one internal transformation I did, was I wanted to make it so that we could solve the problem of what happens if you use a class and you call it, let's say, menu, and then on a different page you also come up with a class called menu, and then through some sort of unfortunate coincidence you end up using some of the code from the other page on the code in the first place, and then the class names clash and one of them stomps on the other one and messes up the styles of the first page. The idea was you could use a namespacing system to prevent this and make it so that when you when you specified the style in the first place, you could specify a little string prefix and it would just traverse all the styles that you were defining in there, class ID, class selector, ID selector, animation keyframes, or animation names rather, and it would just prepend that namespacing string you gave it to all of them, so that instead of ending up with dot menu, you would end up with dot homepage menu or dot sidebar menu or something like that. So it would be namespaced and you wouldn't have to worry about collisions anymore.
Awesome.
That was sort of like the second iteration, and that was around where we started using it at work at No Red Ink. And actually, it may have been Noah who introduced it at work, come to think of it. It wasn't me, but we'd been using SAS almost exclusively up to that point. And dropped it in, started using it on a couple pages. It worked. At first, we were using the approach of putting it all in a style element, even though the design was, the intention was to do it at build time. We didn't do that at first. Eventually, we switched it over and made it be a build step, a part of our build process to compile it to a .css file. But at the time, that was what we were doing. So over the next, 6 to 8 releases, I'm going to guess, it was a lot of just fleshing it out. And this was sort of API expansion, but in a way that was always planned. Like I hadn't set out to say, oh, we're going to support as pairs and compiling to a string and compiling to a style element and compile. It was only just, oh, we're going to be a preprocessor like SAS. We're just going to compile the CSS files. That's the whole deal. So those were sort of unplanned API expansions. But the planned ones were sort of fleshing out the CSS spec and adding support for things that, you know, Flexbox wasn't in there on day one. And then we got Flexbox, and there was a lot of great community contributions from all over the place for these things. Shout out to like Noah, Bob Whitelock, Edward Kovalev, Anton Stromqvist, Luke. Tolga Paksoy actually ended up fixing a number of long-standing compiler bugs. I had some sort of, as this thing got more and more complicated, there were certain edge cases, like certain combinations of things that you could do, which would end up causing things to get the wrong CSS output, even though what you'd specified compiled and was totally fine and made sense. It just wouldn't do the right thing. And he fixed several of those. That was really great help. So another thing that started happening over the course of this time, was that CSS in JS sort of happened. it became popular. So initially, I guess JSS, I think, had been around for quite a while. And there were a couple of things that were all about doing CSS at runtime. And but it had been sort of evolving and getting more and more popular. And it got to the point where I think styled components, to me, in React, seemed like the sort of a turning point where it became really mainstream and popular. I think the thing that got this on a lot of people's minds was a presentation by Christopher Chedeau. Not sure, but he's VJEUX on Twitter and other places.
Yeah.
And it was sort of talking about a lot of the problems that people have with making maintainable CSS, and how doing it in JavaScript solves a lot of those problems. It was a pretty compelling pitch. Now, he was talking about doing it with inline styles, by which I mean the style attribute. But that had a number of problems, such as you couldn't do hovers. I mean, you couldn't do pseudo classes in general.
No media queries.
Couldn't do pseudo elements, right? Media queries. There's just a bunch of stuff that style attributes don't allow. I remember I was talking to Evan about this, and he said this thing that I laughed about at the time, but which later turned out to be kind of profound, which was, he was like, why don't they just fix it? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, why don't they just have the style attribute support that? So what's the problem? I'm like, why doesn't it support those things? It's fine. Like, the browser already knows how to do them. Just let it do that. Why not? And I was like, I don't know. It just doesn't. Okay. So I kind of laughed it off at the time, and then later it turned out to be kind of a source of inspiration. But so basically, where people ended up was trying to actually do the thing that Noah had done for Elm CSS, which was figure out ways of compiling something in the browser through JavaScript to a style element, an actual like style tag on the page. And because those support anything, you can do whatever you want. You just have to, sort of coordinate using classes between what you want on your elements and what you want the styles to be. And so CSS and JS had a lot of obvious parallels to Elm CSS. I mean, you had the, some of the stuff in Christopher's original presentation were some of the same things that I was talking about, which is to say, you want to have imports. So, you can do that. If you've got a Turing complete programming language, you can also do a lot of stuff with code reuse. And so also people were doing kind of a lot of benchmarking, because this was not something that had been really done to a large extent before. And so there was a lot of, there were a lot of question marks, like, okay, we know that if you put stuff in a CSS file, it has good performance. We know that if you build it up at runtime, if nothing else, there's a little bit of extra overhead, because you have to run some JavaScript code, either, in our case, compile the JavaScript code, or in JavaScript's case, just handwritten JavaScript code. I mean, before you even have any styles, you have to run that code. So that's going to be a little bit of extra overhead, but just how much? I mean, is it insignificant? Is it a big deal? Is it a really small deal? Nobody really knew. Over the course of Elm CSS kind of expanding, people started answering these questions, and people started trying these things and using them in production and gathering more data. And kind of where things settled out ended up being, from my observation, that, yeah, this is fine. You can do this. You can write JavaScript that builds styles on the fly and injects it into a style element on the page, usually in the head, and updates it on the fly as necessary. And it's fast enough. It's fast enough that you don't need to worry about it. In the same way that, you know, the virtual DOM was one of these, the same kind of question marks, you know, 5-ish years ago. It was this idea that's like, hey, this will be more ergonomic for the developer, but is it fast enough? And it turns out, yeah, it is fast enough. You can just use that and build performant UIs, and it's great. And the same thing turned out to be true for this approach. And so at this point, having seen this get borne out, I had sort of a question, which was, should we do this? Is this something we should get into? Didn't really know. I didn't really know the answer to that question. And another thing that was happening at the same time was CSS modules by Mark D. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. Dalglish? I'm not sure. Apologies to him. But the idea behind CSS modules was essentially to take the approach that we'd done with Elm CSS, which is not to say that he was inspired by Elm CSS, which I don't think that he was, but rather that it was the same idea, which is we can fix class collisions through namespacing. The trick was that he did it automatically. You didn't have to say, here is the namespace that I want you to use for all of these class selectors and ID selectors, etc. He just generated one based on the file name that they were in. So that way, you just didn't have to think about it at all. You just never got namespace collisions ever again. It's a pretty cool idea. And Styled Components took this even further. I think they were the first ones to do it, but maybe there were others. And they just said, you know what? We're not even going to ask you for a class name. We're going to generate the entire class name from scratch based on the contents of the style. So if you say, I'm going to make a style and it's... display inline block and margin 10 pixels and background color green. I'm just going to take a hash of all those things and that's your class name. And it would just attach it directly to the element itself and say, that's the class name. I'm going to inject that into the style tag for you. And I'm also going to add a class attribute to that element or the React component in this case, but same basic idea, which corresponds to that. So you don't even have to think about class names anymore. You're just worried about styling these things and providing the styles, and that's it. That's the whole deal. You just, you know, it compiles to these hashes and you don't worry about them. Really interesting stuff. And when I compared what they were doing to what we were doing, I was like, wow, it sure would be great if we didn't have to mess with those anymore. If we didn't have to think about, you know, what class names to use or what namespace to manually prepend to these things. This seems like an opportunity for us to improve Elm CSS, you know, the developer experience significantly. And other people have already done the experiments to show that, yeah, these work out in practice. There's a lot of people using them in production. This is not a big risky thing for us to get into. But it did lead to this question of, okay, how much do we want to commit to that? I mean, do we want to make this be the way to do it? Or do we want to support all the different ways that you can currently do it, or a mix of those? And what really brought this question to the forefront was realizing the effect that it had on the ecosystem. So at work, we use a library, like a body 1999, I forget his username. That's embarrassing. It's a body and then some numbers, ABADI. Some of the numbers are ones and some of them are nines. But it's this nice date picker, and we've been using it, and it uses Elm CSS. Now, there's this question of, if you're a library author, and there are all these different ways that you can use Elm CSS, like you can use it to build a .css file, you can use it to inject into a style tag, you can use it as pairs to make a style attribute, which one do you choose? So let's say that he does the compile to a CSS file approach. Well, now if we aren't using that approach, suddenly if we want to use his date picker, we are obliged to introduce that to our build process. Like, we can't just Elm package install his package and then use it. It's not going to work right out the box. We have to actually do the separate step of compiling his Elm CSS into our build process. Or vice versa, let's say that we were saying, okay, we're going to just build CSS files at build time. And then that way, we don't have to have any runtime costs of Elm CSS. Well, now he's saying, let's say he makes the opposite choice and he uses as pairs. It's like, well, cool. Now we can just install it and it just works. And that's great. But now we, even though we went out of our way to move this to like a build time only cost, now we have to get the runtime cost as well. And so it was sort of this impossible to solve thing. Like library authors just have to pick, and whatever they pick, they're potentially going to inconvenience some number of their users. And then I started thinking about, well, what are the long-term consequences of this? Like, let's say it's 5 years from now and people are using this more and more. What are library authors going to end up doing? Well, kind of one of two things is going to happen. Either each library author is going to pick what they want, and then we're going to have this fragmentation where you just can or cannot use an off-the-shelf date picker or whatever other kind of thing you want to use based on whether they happen to choose the same Elm CSS mode as what I chose. Or everybody in the ecosystem is going to kind of rally around one of these as the best, and it's going to be kind of culturally accepted that people use that for their packages. At which point, everybody who used Elm CSS on their application and made a different choice from the package author consensus is now kind of in for a rude surprise when they start trying to use these packages that are depending on Elm CSS. So kind of my conclusion is, you know what? Like, this is my responsibility as the library author. Like, this is a problem that I can solve by just making there only be one way to do it. And then anybody who uses Elm CSS can definitely use off the shelf any library that also uses Elm CSS, no matter what it's doing, because they're going to be doing it in the same way. There's only one way to do it. So then I had a really difficult question to answer, which is, which one, which way do we go? So I kind of looked at all the pros and cons of things. And I wrote this enormous document on I think it was called the long-term plans for Elm CSS. It's on the GitHub repo. And I just did a huge amount of research. I mean, I talked to, Max Stoiber, who made, style components. I talked to Mark Dalglish, who made CSS modules. I talked to Oleg, whose last name I'm forgetting. I'm really horrible at names.
Jackson sounds good. So
many apologies to everyone whose name I'm butchering. But he made JSS, and he wrote an amazing blog post about how to do all this stuff with really great performance, especially animations. And so I did all this research, and I kind of wrote it all down and synthesized my thoughts. And at the very end, my conclusion was, you know what? I think I should do it at build time. I should compile to CSS files because that seems to have the best performance. It seems like any of these ways are fine, but compiling to CSS files means that there's no runtime overhead. So there's no way to possibly get any better performance than that. So that's going to be my tiebreaker, is performance, runtime performance. And I'm going to say that's what everybody should do. There were two problems with this. One was that everybody's doing it at build time, that means that, let's say I want to use a body's date picker and I am not personally using Elm CSS. I have now obliged a body to do it at build time, which means that once again, I'm in the situation where I, as somebody who didn't even use Elm CSS, doesn't necessarily care to use Elm CSS, have this new obligation of introducing something to my build process just to use a body's library. So I kind of realized, you know, this is not just Elm CSS users. This is actually a decision that impacts people who don't use Elm CSS. And if I make the decision to have it be a build time thing only, then it's going to be a negative impact on everybody who doesn't choose to use Elm CSS. I didn't really want that. The other thing that I realized is that there are some things which, Elm CSS can't do if it does things at build time. So the most immediate example of this is you can't change styles based on your model. In other words, you can't change them at runtime. So for example, if I want to animate something and change to a different set of colors, and it changes to a different thing depending on where the user's mouse is. Like, I need to do some computation on their current mouse coordinates in order to decide what style to show. I can't use Elm CSS for that. So what I'm gonna inevitably end up doing is essentially using Elm CSS for 95% of my code, and then the 5% that it can't be done at build time because it depends on real-time information that is not available at build time, then you have to switch to something else. You have to stop using Elm CSS for that. That also didn't seem great to me. And there was one more consideration, which was, you know, even if I am just using a body's library, the absolute best experience for using that is that I just install the package and it just works. Like, I don't actually have to do any extra effort. I just install this package and then I'm like, okay, cool. I have a date picker now. I don't need to modify my build process at all to include his stuff. So at that point, I kind of ended up saying, well, maybe doing it at build time isn't the best, even though it's got, you know, the highest ceiling on performance. You know what I should really do? I should find out, is this a real performance problem, or am I just prematurely optimizing by making the decision based on that? And so that was where I kind of went to the different people like Max Schreiber and Mark Dalgish and kind of talked to them about, hey, what are you seeing with people who are using this? Do people say that, you know, the performance gets bad at some point? Do people say the performance is totally fine? And that was really what cemented it for me, was hearing from them that even with styled components, which does the hashing at runtime, the performance was fine. That was not a pain point for them. And actually, when I talked to Mark Dalgish, like the creator of CSS modules, I mean, he basically said, you know, he uses it internally, you know, because that's what his company's kind of gone with. But a new project from scratch, he would actually choose one of the ones that's doing it at runtime because they're more convenient and the performance is fine. So with all those things put together, I kind of decided, okay, this is it. This is the decision. We're going to go with this, which means that I had to deprecate not only building it at, you know, through the CLI at build time, but also as pairs and also compiling it to just a string. I had to just get rid of all those. And well, they're not gotten rid of yet. Right now they're marked deprecated. By marked, I mean I moved them to a module that starts with deprecated in all caps. and so that was the sort of the decision was, you know, this is the direction we're going to move, and we're going to unify this and say this is going to be the one way to do it. Having said that, it's not lost on me that that there are some people for whom the performance thing actually is really critical. So Noah is a great example of this. I talked to Noah about this when I was, you know, trying to make this decision. And one of the things that he mentioned was that at his company, what they do is they make news stories, like news articles, and they're using Elm and Elm CSS, and they're rendering everything ahead of time. Because, you know, if you're the example he gave was, if you're in a disaster right now and you're trying to get news and, you know, all you've got is a cell phone with a weak signal, page load time really matters. It really needs to be as fast as possible. Everything needs to be as quick as possible to come up. And, you know, it could in some very unusual, but potentially very serious set of circumstances could be, I don't want to say a matter of life and death, but I mean, it could be serious consequences if it's, you know, slower.
Certainly.
So they really want to optimize for that. And so kind of the goal was to come up with a design where we could still make it that if you wanted to, if you really wanted to, you could at least go out of your way and take what the Elm CSS provided as a starting point and build a CLI on top of that to compile the CSS files, with the understanding that this was not going to be sort of like a first class supported thing. This would be like an add-on on top of it, such that everybody who's using Elm CSS, it's extremely clear the first class way to use it is in this one particular way, and there's like a separate thing on top of that if somebody really wants to do this optional thing because they have a particular use case that just absolutely demands it. And so that seemed like kind of the best way forward to balance all these different trade-offs. So I guess that was kind of the third step in the evolution was not actually, you know, a release really. It was just a ton of research and a ton of design work to make this really big decision that's going to impact the long-term future of the library and also how it interacts with the ecosystem. So then I posted some issues. I wrote some things up and kind of explained, okay, I'm going to deprecate this, this, and this, and here's why, and we're going to go with this, and here's why. I did both of them. At first, I did it. I said, I've concluded that we should do this at build time, and here's why. And some people, you know, pushed back, which is totally reasonable. Sebastian Porto and Tomas, I'm forgetting his last name also, from Humio. And they made some good points. And then when switching to the other one, I was like, what do you think about this? You know, now that I've kind of realized the downsides there, and they were like, yep, that actually seems much better for us, which is nice to hear. And so basically, then the next step in the evolution after that was actually coming up with the new runtime only API. And what I ended up doing for this was a technique that Evan kind of, taught me, which is basically figure out what the end goal is. Like, what's the ideal version of this that is, you know, feasible to achieve, and then work backwards to what you can achieve today. So in this case, basically what that means is start by talking to people. So in this case, what I really wanted, I was like, you know, the ideal version of this, having read these blog posts about the performance of these things, what I really want to be doing is, number one, doing what styled components did, which is to say, hashing the styles to come up with a class name and just connecting that for you. So you just never have to think about class names ever again. That was one of the things I wanted. Another, which I knew from the JSS blog posts and other things, was I'd be injecting the styles into a style tag in the head, which is not something that ElmHTML supports right now. So for the first part, I was like, okay, I know I can do this. I mean, there different people have written libraries for doing hashing on things. That's not a problem. But for that, I'm like, well, that's something that doesn't exist in ElmHTML. Will it ever exist? So I talked to Evan about that. I was like, hey, you know, I have this idea. This is like a direction I want to take Elm CSS. I have this compelling use case. I had tons of research to explain why I wanted to go in this direction. And just basically said like, hey, is this something that you can see being added to ElmHTML? Because if not, then I probably don't want to pursue that, right? I don't want to just like get a lot of the way through implementation, kind of assuming that that's going to be something that it makes sense for Elm to support, and then end up finding out, nope, actually that's a deal breaker. And I'm like, whoops, well, maybe I should have talked more first. That's definitely something that I've kind of come to appreciate about building libraries is talk to people. Talk first, code later. It's definitely, you know, if you're going to make a contribution to the ecosystem, it's really important to just understand the perspectives of different people in that ecosystem and kind of like what they have planned and how you're just like thinking really critically and from an informed position about how what you're making will fit in. So when I talked to Evan and kind of presented this, he was like, yeah, this makes sense. This seems like, you know, this was not something that he was planning to add, but the use case was pretty compelling. The data that other people had collected about the performance of these things indicated that this was really the best way to do this. So he said, cool. Okay. This is not a top priority right now, but it's something that we can add later on as a performance optimization. So that really helped me focus on saying like, okay, I know what the long-term goal is. Like long-term, we want to design something that can use that to get the best performance possible. But in the meantime, can I come up with something that is as close to that as possible from a UX perspective, such that when we get to that future, I can just kind of incrementally upgrade what I've been building to that. And the design I ended up coming up with was essentially, circling back to what we were talking about earlier, what if style attributes just worked? Like, what if they supported hover and they supported media queries and all of those things? And so what I ended up for a design was, instead of an attribute called style, it's an attribute called CSS. And what it takes as an argument is a list of Elm CSS styles. And so background color and margin and so forth. And those can include also hover, which is a function that takes more styles and only applies them on hover. And same thing with media queries. And that was it. That was the whole learning curve right there. Was if you already know Elm CSS, all you got to do is just take your, you know, your button element, let's say, and instead of giving it a style attribute, you give it a CSS attribute, and it'll just take care of all that stuff behind the scenes. It will compile your styles to CSS. It will inject them into a style tag somewhere on the page. It'll automatically generate a class using a hash of all the styles. And not only will it add that to the style tag on the page, but it'll also add that as an attribute on the button. So it's completely seamless. It feels just like using a style attribute, except instead of using raw strings, you're using Elm CSS values. And at the end of the day, it all just works. You don't have to do any more work than that. You get to use hovers, you get to use media queries, you get to use absolutely the full range of CSS stuff. It's all type checked. It all just sort of works. And if a body is using this, you know, he can just do that in his package. You can install it and use it without having to alter your build process at all. All of the goals sort of ended up being met. Now, the one trick there, which is something that is true today, but is, you know, something that when that becomes enough of a priority to work on, it can stop being true in the future, is that in order to track that information of, you know, this button actually contains not only the description of the element itself, but also a description of styles for use later on in rendering them to a style element, I couldn't just use the normal HTML type for that button. So what I came up with was essentially wrapping it, coming up with a drop-in replacement for the HTML value, which just tracks that information and is otherwise the same. So what I did is I called it HTML.styled, and then I had to come up with, you know, corresponding, basically all the HTML packages needed an equivalent styled package. So there's HTML.styled, there's HTML.attributes.styled, HTML.events.styled, HTML.lazy, and HTML.keyed.styled. Or no, sorry, HTML.styled.keyed. Anyway. So essentially what I did was I just copy-pasted them. I just took the ones from the website, just looked at the source, copy-pasted it, and just did a quick find replace to make it use this this extra my type instead of the underlying type. And then at the very end, there's like one thing you have to do called toUnstyled, which takes this HTML.styled value and converts it to a normal Elm HTML value, which includes not only the whole structure, but also the extra style tag that has the compiled styles in it. So that sounds like a lot of work, but it was actually very quick to do because that library doesn't change very often. And so it was, you know, just kind of a copy paste job. And from a UX perspective, it's super easy to do because all you have to do is just go through any place you want to use Elm CSS. Wherever you say import HTML, you find replace that with import HTML.styled and you're done. That's basically it. I mean, the one other thing you have to do is you have to, in one place at your very top level view function, call toUnstyled, like pipe your, you know, all your other calls to toUnstyled in one place, add one line of code total, and you're done. And now you can use this CSS attribute in any of your elements anywhere. And this is an interesting thing because on the one hand, thinking about what I did to implement this, it sounds like I'm just making the biggest mess ever. I mean, I'm literally copy pasting another library into my library, exposing all of it. And I'm just making one change, which is, you know, a wrapper around that. But there's two things to consider here. One is this is the intermediate solution. The long-term solution is the idea is that this is something that, becomes first class supported in a much nicer performance, you know, more performant way, through the Elm HTML library itself, at which point I can just delete all those modules and implement it in terms of that, and then we're done. Another thing to mention is that as like what is the actual consequence for me as a maintainer and for users of this library? And the answer in both cases is basically nothing. It's really minimal. I mean, HTML library changes very infrequently. I mean, it's you know, it changed a decent amount or with decent frequency when it first came out, but I mean, we're past that now. It's not something that's changing on a, you know, on a regular basis. So the burden for me, you know, Elm CSS in sync with that is extremely low. The other thing to keep in mind is what's the burden on end users? And again, also extremely low. They just do replace HTML with HTML.styled and now things just work. It's just a drop-in replacement. There is a little bit of an annoying interim compatibility issue with other libraries that rely on HTML in some cases. So if somebody else is using, let's say somebody makes a date picker that's not using Elm CSS, that's no problem. There's a function called fromUnstyled, which says basically just give me something in traditional HTML and I'll convert it to HTML.styled. So that's one extra function call to use somebody else's date picker. Not a big deal. the bigger deal is with a library like Tessa Kelly's accessible HTML library. So this is basically a way of making it so that doing accessibility in Elm is really easy, and it's really easy to follow best practices. And it'll have things like you mentioned Matt Griffith's style elements library, which is super awesome, by the way. If anyone listening to this has not seen that library, I highly recommend it, and I recommend it so much that I gave a talk about it. you should really check that out. It's a serious departure from CSS in an extremely good way, and Matt is awesome. So one of the things that style elements and accessible HTML have in common is that they make it so that when you create an image, you actually have to specify some alternative text to it. Like, there's a string argument that's not optional, so you can't forget to specify that for screen readers. But that's something where I can't just like fix that with toUnstyled, because when somebody calls that function, they also want to give it a list of attributes. They like to, you know, if I'm using Tessa's library, I want to say image and I give it the string. Then the next argument is a list of normal HTML attributes, not styled attributes. So if I'm using Tessa's library and I want to use Elm CSS, at least today, I can't do both. I have to pick one or the other. So the only solution to that is to basically make also a drop-in replacement for Tessa's library. Now, it's pretty obvious that that doesn't scale over the long term, right? I mean, this is like, I'm just not going to be copy-pasting everybody's library just to, you know, indefinitely to solve all these problems. But again, this isn't the long-term design. This is just a short-term thing. So I don't have to think about, you know, these are my scaling characteristics forever. You know, because I coordinated with Evan ahead of time, I can actually know that this is explicitly the short-term design, and there's a better long-term design that we can move towards afterwards. This lets us, you know, figure out all the rough spots and work out all the problems with the library before Evan has bandwidth to add that to Elm HTML. So that's where we are today. That's actually the current version. Version 13. Oh yeah, I should explain the 12 to 13, like the emergency fix I had to do, which actually was kind of cool because it revealed something about how my API design sensibilities have also evolved over the course of maintaining more libraries and sort of getting better at this stuff. The bug that happened was basically, let's say I've got this CSS attribute and I've got my button. I say CSS, I say padding 10 pixels, background color green. And that's all I got going on with that button. What happens if I put another CSS attribute in that list? Well, so in Elm, these are ultimately compiling down to classes, and classes and class attributes stack. So if I give it two classes, foo and bar, what that will ultimately give me in the DOM is a class name on that element of foo space bar. It'll just stick those two classes together, which is pretty nice. And so my thinking with Elm CSS is, oh, that'll just work. If I use two CSS attributes side by side, well, they'll just compile down to classes. They'll get concatenated together with spaces in between, and both of the styles will get applied. So I actually sort of like advertised this as, this is another way you can mix and match styles. I mean, you have the normal SAS post CSS, less stylist style, mixing and matching of mix in type things that you could always do since the very first beginning of Elm CSS. But now there's a second way that you can compose styles, which is just put them all together into an actual HTML attribute and just put two of them in your attribute list for your element. That'll work too. But there was something that I had not anticipated about that case. And it only happened after library, and somebody reported it as not a bug per se, but a potential bug. So what they reported was, okay, let's say that I say CSS and I say background color green, padding 10 pixels. And then the other one, I say, margin 20 pixels, padding 40 pixels. So now I have two conflicting definitions of padding. The first attribute says padding 10 pixels. The second one says padding 40 pixels. Now, what these are going to compile to is two different CSS classes that are based on the hash of the styles in the CSS list. And then they're going to generate a style tag, which includes both of those class definitions. And here's the problem. Which of those two wins? Like, is it the 10 pixels that I specified in the first CSS attribute, or is it the 40 pixels that I specified in the second CSS attribute?
I think it's the one that comes later in the style sheet.
Exactly. Sheet. And the style sheet, we've now said, is not something I should think about. Like, right. If I'm using this library, I should all I'm thinking about is the HTML. And here's the really scary part. Because these are hashes of classes, there's no guarantee about in which order they get output to the style sheet. And it could potentially be, you know, alphabetical, for example. So let's say I now add, let's say I put those two in there and it says, oh, you know what? By coincidence, the 40 pixel padding one wins. Cool. Now let's say later on, I go back and add something to the other style, like the other one that's not padding 40 pixels, the one that's padding 10 pixels. And I add some innocuous style like opacity 0.9. And suddenly the padding changes.
Love it.
It's like, what? Wait. why would that happen?
Good.
And the answer would be that the hash changed and now it's in a different alphabetical order and now it gets emitted higher up in the style sheet and so it becomes 10 pixels rather than 40 pixels. And as soon as he pointed this out, I was like, oh no, this is really bad. I mean, this is, imagine the bugs that you would get from this, the behavior you would see if you ran afoul of this. This would be awful to try and debug these things. So then I had a choice to make. How do you solve it? I mean, clearly the status quo is unacceptable. I mean, I just totally missed this one, you know, in all the design changes I was making. It just had not occurred to me that this could happen. But it was immediately apparent that there were two ways, big picture, that I could solve this, is to just disallow this and just say, you know what, if you use multiple CSS attributes, it's just going to pick the last one and all the others are going to get ignored. Now, there are some pros and cons to this. The pro is it's super easy to learn, and once you're used to using the library, you'll just kind of forget it exists. You just immediately learn that you know that doesn't do anything. Like adding extra attributes is not going to cause any have any effect, so you just don't do it. And if you forget and accidentally do it, well, you're going to get a very predictable output from that. Like you're going to look at the page, you're going to say, "Oh, that didn't do anything." So, all right, fine. And that's just sort of always going to be the case for those attributes. It's very predictable, very simple. But it does mean that you've lost this way of composing styles. The other way to do it would be to say, okay, we're just going to resolve those ourselves. We're going to keep track of, here's all the styles, like not just the class, but we're actually going to keep track of what all the key value pairs of the styles were, and we'll merge them. So we'll sort of do this resolution in a consistent way for you. And this is a really interesting example because there were different people on both sides of this in the community who were commenting on the issue and saying like, oh, I think we should do it this way. I think you should do it that way. Actually, that's a little bit inaccurate. That was the more popular option, was to say we should do the resolution ourselves somehow. And there are a few suggestions of how to do that. One was compile to different class names, like what Tachyons does or what Atomic CSS does, because they claim that there's actually performance benefits to doing it that way. So you would compile to a bunch of different class names, and then it could potentially open up some different ways to resolve this. Then there were some other, anyway, there were a bunch of different discussions about how to potentially do that. And because of my experience designing APIs, I remember kind of like reading over this and discussing the different options. And it just sort of dawned on me like, oh, this is actually very clear what I should do. It is extremely clear that is without a doubt correct that I should just ban this and just say, you can't do this anymore. Just do the first way and say, there's just one way to compose these styles, which is using, you know, the mix-in style. And the reason I realized this is that one of the things that has become one of the most popular parts of Elm that people say they really like about Elm is that there's one way to do it. If you have some task that you want to do in Elm, you're like, I want to accomplish this thing, especially in comparison to JavaScript, you don't need to spend time debating between a bunch of different approaches. Someone already made that decision for you, and it's going to be a nice way to do it. Like, we already have a nice way to do this. All I would be changing is saying, yeah, now that one nice way of doing it with mix-ins to compose styles, that's the only way to do it. The end. Of course that's what I want to choose, right? It eliminates this whole problem. And it's not only is it the simplest solution, but it's also the solution that lowers the learning curve the most. It means that I no longer have to tell people, okay, first of all, there's this alternate way to do it where you can use multiple CSS attributes in the same element. That's another way that you can compose these things. Second of all, once you've done that, I need to explain to you what happens in this situation where there's a conflict because two of them are using the same attribute. Third, I need to explain how that's going to get resolved. Here are our algorithms for doing that, so you know what to expect and you'll understand why you're seeing what you're seeing on the screen. It's like, oh, or I could just say, that doesn't work. The end. And so at, you know, once I kind of realized this, I was like, oh, whew. I thought this was going to be a really hard decision, but it's actually very easy. And so that was what version 13 was. I mean, that was a breaking change. So I kind of deliberately batched it with something else that also needed a major version bump, because if you were relying on this before, I really didn't want anyone to upgrade and then just automatically upgrade to like a patch version, even though there were no API change. And then just suddenly be like, wait a minute, my styles are different. Why are my styles different? So what I did was basically tried to get the word out that this change was coming. I didn't think anyone was likely to be using it, and I actually haven't heard of anyone getting bitten by that change. But basically said like, hey, FYI, this is a breaking change. Watch out. You know, if you were doing this before, you got to stop doing it because it's not going to do anything anymore. So version 13 has been out. We've started using it a little bit at work, and we're going to be starting to use it more and more. And so far it's been extremely well received. People have been really happy with the API. It's apparently been pretty easy for people to pick up. All the people who were doing stuff before so far that I've heard of have been able to switch. And overall, it's just been really successful. And I think it's sort of a testament to all of the awesome contributions from people in the community and all of the people who put so much work into the design input on this, like Noah and Max and Mark and Luke, and just all the people who spent so much time just talking about these things and about like helping, you know, shape the future design goals of the library. Like, and of course, Evan and Tessa, you know, also just putting in their, you know, like how this affects other parts of the ecosystem, which is also so important to figuring out what's going to be good in the long term. So I, you know, throughout these couple of years that I've been working on it, I think more than any other library I've worked on, this one's the one that's changed the most and that I've kind of learned the most from.
Well, this is incredible. I mean, I actually wasn't aware of its current state and how mammoth an effort and change this has been. So this has been a very, this has been an enthralling episode for me to record. And the interesting thing is too, as you were talking through these, I've been doing my own challenges with styling, et cetera, in my own projects, and have run into a lot of the same problems. So as you were talking, I was going, So that's really a nice thing to hear that you solved these. I'm going to take another look at this. So let's just think of this episode as a back-to-back. It was like a twofer. But here's the interesting thing.
You know what's
funny? Go ahead.
We went way over on time, and I apologize for that. But the thing that I expected to be spending a bunch of time on is like what the next version is going to have, but I'm not even going to start on that. I sent you a link to the issue that's talking about it with like phantom types and all that stuff.
I was about to mention that and say like, let's do another episode if you're on board for that, about just that, totally. If you're okay. Yeah, let's do that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I can, I talk about stuff that I learned. That one was a case where I didn't even realize that you could do those things until Ian McKenzie from the New York City L meetup introduced it to me. And yeah, really cool stuff. But yeah, let's not open that box right
Great.
Now.
Great. Okay, let's save that one for a future episode. And also maybe we should do Elm Test on a future episode too. Because I think this vein of learning, I think, is valuable to me, and I hope valuable to newcomers, to know why the libraries are how they are and how they've changed. That's really pretty neat.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, I mean, it hasn't changed as much as Elm CSS, but there's a bunch of really cool stuff on the horizon that, yeah, I would love to do a future episode once we've actually implemented those things.
Okay.
And yeah, so definitely would love to circle back up about that. I'm really excited about 2018.
Excellent. Yeah, it's promising to be a good year. Let's hope it all plays out as it's looking right now. All right, Richard. Well, I think that I'm going to just skip any links I might have had at the end unless you really want to stick something in.
I think I've rambled on for long enough. So
okay. Well, we'll wrap up this this back-to-back, this double feature, and we will plan on doing this again soon. So thank you so much for your time, Richard, and thank you to your listeners for your attention. We appreciate it, and have a great time.
Thanks.